The White House that President Trump has constructed has a lot of chiefs.
If she had become president, the world would still be this complicated.
This will probably get me in a lot of trouble, but I do think there is a degree of admiration for a strong man. I'm sorry.
I have never seen anything like this. People just flat out lie.
Welcome to the Global Politico. I'm Susan Glasser, and each week I'll be taking you backstage in a world disrupted. Join us every Monday morning for new episodes. Rate and subscribe to us on iTunes or whatever your preferred podcast platform is. And do email me anytime at sglasser@politico.com. And now, this week's show. Hi, I'm Susan Glasser, and this week, the Global Politico hits the road again to Great Britain, where I reported from the scene of last week's terrorist attack in Manchester, as it caused an unprecedented halt to political campaigning just 2 weeks before the general election. Prime Minister Theresa May called the election the Brexit election and saw it as a way of winning a stronger hand to negotiate Brexit with Europe. But now it's not at all clear that she'll get that bigger conservative majority that she had hoped, never mind what's going to happen to Brexit. So in this week's podcast, we'll look at the backstory of Brexit, how it does and doesn't compare with the populist wave that's brought us Donald Trump in the United States and a host of political upheavals in other countries. Our guest for most of the podcast is Steve Hilton, who was long a British political guru of the first ranks. Once so close to former British Prime Minister David Cameron, he was known as David's brain. Steve broke ranks with Cameron over the Brexit referendum, which he supported and which spelled the end of Cameron's prime ministership when it won in last year's shocking upset. These days, Steve lives in California, in the heart of Silicon Valley, and he'll bring his brand of what they call red Toryism, basically, in American terms, kindler, gentler conservatism, to Fox News, starting in June, when he gets his own weekly TV show. For the rest of the podcast, I thought we'd do something a little bit different, and end with some of our on-the-ground reporting from Manchester, where Steve's big ideas about Brexit and what a future outside Europe could look like come crashing into some more mundane political realities for British voters. People like the dentist from Nottingham I met at a cafe here, not far from where the terrorist attack against the Ariana Grande concert occurred. He's still against Brexit all the way, believes it's a terrible mistake for the country. In fact, he's not even sure he knows what to think of his country anymore. Then there was Kate, a Polish waitress who's been in England for 4 years. She's no longer sure she's welcome in the UK, and surprised and saddened that England turned out to be different than the country she expected to find. As Britain prepares once again to vote, amid worries about a terror plot still being unraveled here in Manchester as we're recording this, I found myself thinking what an uncertain time this is. It's a whole country that can't plan, that has no idea, thanks to Brexit, exactly what the next few years will bring. So thanks again for joining us on the Global Politico. Thanks again to Steve Hilton for being our guest this week. There's no one I've met in the last 6 months who is better at talking about this wave of nationalist populism that has occurred here, not only in the United States, also in Great Britain. Now we're seeing in Europe the glimmerings of maybe a different version of it, even in your native or your parents' native Hungary, obviously a very different and in many ways much more troubling version of it. So you have really, I think, a very global perspective on this political upheaval, the disruption. Did you know this was coming? I mean, how is this all happening at the same time?
I think my short answer is I felt it was coming and I hoped it was coming. I think that the underlying cause of the political disruption we've seen, most notably in the UK with Brexit and here with Donald Trump's election, but as you say, happening pretty much in every other democracy. You see the signs of it all over the place. I think the underlying cause is something that is economic in nature. It feels to me that if you look at the data and if you look at the stories of people's lives, you've had a complete collapse of economic security that's happened for people over the last, not just the last few years, the last few decades, I'd say. And the data goes back a long way to show that people's, you know, their their basic economic security, the just getting through life, being able to afford the basics of a decent life, the expectation that you'll just that will be there for you, has just gone for not just a small group of people at the bottom of the income scale in some countries. We've always had problems of poverty, and governments have consistently tried to address that all over the world. This is a much bigger phenomenon. For example, in the US, if you look at the data here, I remember last year in the election campaign being really struck just before, I think it must have been September or October, something like that, new income data was released. And the President Obama and Democrats jumped on that and said, this is great news because for the first time since the Great Recession, incomes were up in America, right across the income scale. Mm-hmm. I think there's an average of 5% up. That's great news. Incomes have gone up finally. That's true. And it was great news. It remains great news. But the New York Times published a highly revealing chart that I thought told the story, not just of last year's election, but all of this political disruption better than anything else I've seen. It was an incredibly simple graphic which showed what had happened to incomes, not just last year, but over the last 20 or so years. And even taking into account last year's increase, the median income in America, median household income, was still lower than in 1999. Now, if you look at the picture, half of American households earning less today than in 1999, the poorer you are, the worse off you are, and everyone else has gone up. That's the basic story. And I think that if you ally to that, the other thing that's really happened, I think, right across the board in different democracies, which is not just a collapse of economic security, but also a collapse in the social fabric of life. Because you've seen a much greater centralization of government, of big business, a collapse in community institutions. That as well, I think, has contributed to this sense that people have, which is that they have less and less control over the things that matter to them, that decisions are being made about their lives by someone else far away from them, whether that's physically and certainly in terms of their understanding of their lives. The decisions that affect them are being made somewhere else. They are suffering. They're getting poorer. The things that are familiar around them are disappearing. And meanwhile, a bunch of rich people are getting richer. And so that's driving all of it, I think.
Well, that's right. You're not just a blue sky ideas guy, although that was, in fact, the role that you played for David Cameron in his ascendance to become Prime Minister in Great Britain. But you've also seen what happens when those ideas collide with the politics, with the realities of governing. And by the way, you're not friends with David Cameron today, in part, I think, because of your experience on the inside.
Yeah, I mean, that you're right that prior to the election in the UK that resulted in David Cameron becoming Prime Minister in 2010, my main role was developing our political strategy and our policy platform, and that required a lot of creative thinking and working with many organizations just in the normal policy development process. And then once in office, while I was working in Downing Street, really my responsibility was the implementation of all of that, trying to actually make it happen. I think the way I would put this is that we have had a bit of a political revolution. You see it with Brexit. You see it in Donald Trump's election. You see it with the fact that neither of the main parties have ended up in the final round of the French presidential election. You see it with the Italian referendum being defeated. You see it in a lot of ways, the political revolution. But you haven't had anywhere the real revolution that's needed, which is a policy revolution. That hasn't happened. We haven't even seen the start of that. And I think that's the part of this that is the thing that would make actual difference in people's lives and deal with the frustrations that have led to the political expression of that. But it hasn't been matched yet anywhere by policy reform of the revolutionary kind that I think we need. In terms of making things happen in office, I think that the difficulties of that, I think that's kind of what I'm talking about in terms of the policy revolution. Because going back to the UK context, when we were running for office, when we were putting forward our agenda in the lead up to the 2010 election, it was a pretty revolutionary message. And the idea at the heart of it was that the thing that had gone wrong with not just the economy, but also the way in the UK services, public services like education and healthcare and policing had been delivered was that you'd seen over the years under governments of all different political ideologies far too much concentration of power. Everything had become too centralized, too big, too bureaucratic, and it was time to devolve power and put power directly in people's hands, sometimes through devolving power in the political sense. A big plank of our platform was to have more, to give more power to local government and actually to create in the UK for the first time directly elected mayors in big cities like we see here in America. But also throughout public services, more choice for parents in schools, neighborhoods getting control over their budget. There's a whole range of things that we argued for before the election. And in fact, one of the things that kind of brings that alive, I think, better than anything, this is a slightly obscure, nerdish thing, but I think some of our listeners might enjoy it, which is that I think the title of the manifesto, the platform document, the policy platform, really was very revealing, and we spent a lot of time thinking about it, because usually these things are just unbelievably bland. It's, you know, the Conservatives, you know, the best future for Britain or something
like that. Moving America forward.
That, yeah, but it's like, what's that brilliant one in Veep? It's a bit like the title of the memoir.
Oh, there is one in Veep that's so...
it's her book, isn't it? It's like something tomorrow. What is it?
Toward a better tomorrow or whatever. But that's actually a real organization here in Washington too, right?
Well, it was that kind of thing. Usually it's that incredibly bland, it doesn't say anything. We wanted to be different. And in fact, the title, literally the title of the document printed on the front cover was Invitation to Join the Government of Britain. Mm-hmm. And it was really different to the normal stuff. And we really chose that carefully because we wanted to convey the sense that this would be a revolution, that we're going to really devolve power and put power back in people's hands over every aspect of their life, bring more competition in the private sector, decentralize power in the economy, you name it, right? Right across the board, it was all about people power, devolving power. And then, of course, you're there in the heart of government controlling the levers of power. David Cameron actually said, I want to be the first prime minister that leaves office having given away power rather than accumulating it. And, of course, that's where the reality hits in. And one of the experiences that I found was that commitment to genuinely breaking up those structures and institutions of concentrated power, it's very hard to stick to once you're presiding over them. And I ended up constantly fighting and battling and arguing with not just the bureaucracy in the kind of cliched portrayal of these things. It's the sort of incoming new broom fighting the bureaucracy that's been entrenched. That's definitely true. There's no question that that happens. I remember a meeting with Tony Blair, which I had to do pretty much in secret, but before the election, asking him for advice. I thought, you know, he'd been in office and actually was on the record as saying that he left power almost exactly at the time when he finally understood how to use it properly.
Right.
And so I thought, well, here's someone who really knows how things work. He had a radical agenda and so on. I didn't agree with all of it, but still very useful. So I went to him for advice. And I remember the thing that stuck in my mind most was he said, you cannot overestimate the degree to which the civil service and the bureaucracy genuinely see themselves as the guardians of the national interest. And it is their job to frustrate the here today, gone tomorrow politicians who come in with their crazy schemes. So that is how they think. You have to realize that they really are there trying to stop you doing what you do. And you've got to understand that and be ready to fight them. So, of course, it's true about the permanent bureaucracy. And I got into a lot of arguments about exactly that. To me, it seemed vital that we had to reform and frankly, massively reduce the central policy bureaucracy. The analog here in DC would be the federal bureaucracy that we hear so much about. I think that is a huge part of what's needed in terms of draining the swamp. You've got, and in the conclusion I came to after being there in a very similar situation in the UK, as happens here in DC, is that there's only one way to do it, which is to literally cut it, not just by a little bit, but massively. My proposal was that we should reduce the central policy making and implementation bureaucracy to 10% of its size. Not a 10% cut, but to 10% of what it is. So you can imagine how that went down. But the reason I mentioned that specific is that that's the kind of scale of change I think that's needed. But remember, it's not just that. It would be really wrong to characterize it. It's just the bureaucrats are the enemy.
Ultimately, it's your political partners, too, who didn't want to go where you wanted to go.
And that really was – and I – you know, and my view was, well, fair enough. They're the ones who are elected. I'm an unelected advisor. I can't insist on my way. I happen to think that I was trying to represent the platform that we were elected on and be true to that. But in the end, it is the elected politicians who make decisions. And they, too, were reluctant to go as far as we had said we would go. And there are a number of instances, which I've spoken publicly about and others I haven't, where you know, literally specific things that we had promised. The mayor's is a good example, the devolution of power to direct elections, which I think would make a huge difference. Because as we know, and same here in America, you know, so many of the decisions that affect people's lives, rightly, are handled at the local or certainly at the state level. In the UK, you don't have any of that. That was an explicit promise that was directly sabotaged, not by the bureaucracy, but by the politicians in the government that I was part of in terms of working for them. And that is one of the reasons I started my company CrowdPack, which is designed to try and break that old system of party funding by making it easier for people to run for office and get elected without relying on the party machines. Because when the minute you rely on the party machines, both organizationally and for fundraising, what that brings with it is a complete adherence to a certain set of interests.
Right. So step one of the revolution is blow up the parties. But
not necessarily blow up, but just start to create alternatives for people to get elected to positions of power so that once there, they can be either literally independent or just more independent-minded, so they're not just totally beholden to the institutions that got them there.
Well, so let's talk for a second a little bit of biography. You go inside the government. You see you have these ideas. You've even gotten the conservatives to sort of remake their image around your new agenda. You come inside. You're very personally close to David Cameron in addition to that. You were the godfather to his son. You were friends for a long time. This was a shared project. Flash forward to last May, just a year ago, the Brexit campaign. Boom, right in the middle of that, David Cameron's close friend, his advisor, the guy who helped to bring him there, Steve Hilton, publishes an explosive article. And says, not only do we need the Brexit, but it's directly because we've got to take back power. I was struck by this language from arrogant, unaccountable, hubristic elites. Implicitly, those are the elites not only in Brussels at the European Union, but of course inside British politics today. What led up to that? And I don't know, have you even spoken with Cameron since then? I mean, you know, this is part of your own personal journey in understanding what happens to ideas in politics, right? And that England and would need to take such a dramatic step, you know, really speaks to your own disillusionment with the system as it operated.
Yes. I mean, the thing that the way I would characterize it is that I believe that everything I've argued for and fought for and worked on, whether that's in politics or in business, the theme I think that has linked all that is this belief in people power, in this rejection of the. I really believe that for too long, elites. An establishment. And I know those are cliches, but you know we all know what we do. The people who've made the decisions have been arrogant, have been detached from the realities of people's lives, and that's why people's lives haven't got better to the degree that we'd want. I think that's been the consistent theme, and that going back to what I just spoke about in terms of our election plan, you know, putting power in people's hands was the central idea of the Conservative platform, and so to me, the EU was the direct opposite of that and totally inconsistent. And the reason is that I think many people in America think of the EU in one of two ways, perhaps both. I just read a very good piece by David Frum in The Atlantic, who I greatly admire, and I know him a little bit. And I think that but it revealed, I think, that the mistake I think that a lot of distant observers make about the EU, where they think either that it's just a single market, like a bit like a European version of NAFTA. What's wrong with that? That's great. I agree it's great, if that's all that it was. Or they see it as a security institution. That's completely wrong. Right. It's not.
It's not NATO.
And every time it's tried to do that, it's been a disaster. Trying to agree a common European foreign policy or a European – it's always been a disaster. What it actually is, it is true that it's a single market, and I totally support that element of it. But what it actually is a federal government for Europe. Yeah. And in fact, what you find in the EU is that and this is the part I think that is really missed in a lot of the international coverage of Brexit, is that a member state within the EU has far less policy freedom than a state within the USA. To give you a specific example, one of the things that I really prioritize working in government in terms of domestic policy was family policy. There was 8 or 9 of those every week. Of policies where you thought, what on earth has, why should this be decided at the European level? Now, the other aspect of that European decision making is it's completely undemocratic. At least in, look, everyone hates, you know, goes on about the federal government and the federal bureaucracy here in Washington. We hate the federal government. Why can't we have, you know, power to the states, all that kind of stuff. But at least the federal government is elected. At least, you know, the president is elected, Congress is elected. At least there's a democratic aspect to it. In the EU, the initiation of policy comes from the European Commission, not the European Parliament, the European Commission, an appointed body, a committee of 27 countries where everything is haggled away.
Nonetheless, it was both an explosive decision to pursue Brexit and it won.
But I thought
really
it was completely consistent with everything I'd argued. In fact, David Cameron and all my friends and colleagues always knew that my position for a long time had been open, not just a Eurosceptic as he was, but also that I actually argued for leaving the EU to be official Tory policy. Mm-hmm. I argued that privately in our policy discussions. So my position was always very clear.
For years.
Yes, prior to the 2010 election.
Exactly. And so David Cameron, in your view, had supported this, but never was willing to politically.
No, I wouldn't put it that far. I wouldn't go that far. I would say that I made that argument internally. As you said, we've been friends for years. We know how we felt. He was highly criticized by many, if you'd like, you could call them mainstream or establishment Tories in the UK for his decision or his position in running for the leadership. When he stood for the leadership of the Conservative Party, one of the pledges he made was to take the British Conservatives out of the main centre-right grouping in the European Parliament and the EPP, I think, is the European People's Party, and create a new group because he argued that sort of mainstream grouping, which included Angela Merkel's party, was too pro-Europe. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to be part of a more Eurosceptic. That was his idea, not my idea. And he was really criticized for it by the mainstream. So he's a Eurosceptic.
Right. But when you privately discussed this with him, he couldn't go the next step of supporting the Brexit last year.
Well, but a lot had changed. I mean, we're talking about, you know, pre-2010.
Right.
I mean, my specific suggestion, if I remember, was that if we had a – the way I put it was this. If it's our long-term goal to leave the EU, which I think it is, then how do we get there? And my argument was if we announce that as our position today prior to being elected, it would be seen as too extreme. There was not the public consensus around that, and it was a political risk. So that wasn't – I didn't advocate that. My argument was a long-term one. I said we need to get to a position where it is possible to imagine that leaving the EU being supported by the British people. And in order to do that, we need a different strategy about how we handle Europe. Traditionally, British governments, Conservative and Labour, made no difference. You'd always see the same pattern. European decisions would come up and they'd go to Brussels and have the summit, and they'd all come out and they'd go to do their press conference and say, that was a great result for Britain. We won on this, this, and this, and we had to concede on that, but that was great. We got our way. That's the traditional presentation, even though it's not, just not true. But the constant presentation was like, we're doing well. We're beating back the Brussels right. bureaucracy. And of course, it's not true, but you could see why they wanted to. Mrs. Thatcher did the same. It's not a partisan point to make. They just wanted to convey this idea that the UK was winning against the sort of monsters of Brussels. My argument was, well, actually, we know it's not true because the regulation, the policy intervention, the degree of control over domestic policy keeps getting bigger. So it's clearly not true that we're winning. We're continually losing. You may have the odd victory here and there, but the general direction is more centralization in the EU. So why don't we just say that? And instead of leaving the summit and saying, great, we got what we wanted, I'm really sorry, but we didn't, I'm afraid, manage to persuade our European partners of this. And therefore, we do have to accept this new regulation or this new intrusion into our domestic policymaking from Brussels. And I'm very sad about that, but there's nothing we can do because that's the way it works. And so my argument was if we actually changed that strategy and just told the truth about the EU over the period of a government, over the lifetime of 5 years of a government, then actually you might get to a position where the British people would accept leaving as not just sensible, but necessary. And in fact, that happened without that strategy. And he said, well, okay, I hear what you're saying, but I don't think that's what we're going to be doing. And in fact, when once in office, perhaps unsurprisingly, he behaved like all the other prime ministers. You know, they're there, he's in the meeting, I'm not. You know, he's sitting around the table with Angela Merkel and others. He has a different perspective. So I'm not surprised that he changed his view, because that's what happens. You know, he's the leader. Like I say, you know, I have the luxury of sort of sitting back at base and just sort of watching, whereas he's actually in the room with the leaders, and that must change your perspective.
So take me a little bit back to this Brexit campaign last year. You come out publicly. It's a really divisive issue in the party that you helped to build up and to bring to power, obviously, not just some personal dynamic between you and the prime minister, but, you know, basically everybody has to pick a side. And mm-hmm. now we also see the shocking outcome. You know, were you surprised? How much did it really rip the Conservative Party apart? I mean, it seems almost like a classic ideology versus pragmatism, kind of a divide that erupted.
Funnily enough, I think that it was a unifying thing for the Conservative uh-huh. Party. I think that truly, I mean, of course, there were and remain some members of the party, both locally at the grassroots level and nationally, who favoured staying in the EU. But a big majority was for leaving. And actually, well, going back to the pub, I wasn't around. I left the UK and working in Downing Street in 2012.
Right. So
I've been out
California.
For a long time. Yeah. Exactly. The reason for doing it, I think, was partly to try and bring some closure to this argument that had just bedeviled the British Tories for decades and had actually been pretty much at the heart of the failure in the end, or the demise of most of the previous leaders since Margaret Thatcher. So I think one of the things that he's trying to do was say, look, this argument keeps going on. Let's just bring it to, let's do it. Let's have the argument and then settle the matter. That was one of the reasons for doing it. I think it did settle the matter to a certain extent, but not the way he wanted it to be settled.
So obviously it was an incredible upset. And there was no person who seized on that more than Donald Trump, who hadn't, by the way, previously really seemed to be all that interested in questions of the European bureaucracy in Brussels, or, you know, he was asked about it just a few weeks before the referendum and didn't seem to be familiar with the details. But then as soon as Brexit became the upset of the century and there was this notion, wow, maybe there's this populist wave, of course, Trump said, I'm going to be Brexit. I'm going to be the next Brexit. And then obviously to our shock, he was. Tell me a little bit about someone who's watched both British and American politics. Is there a commonality between Brexit and Trump? What is it? Were the electorates being driven by some common thing? Or was it just that there were two big upsets in the same year that had nothing?
No, I think there's a much closer. You can't say that they're identical, but I think there really is a close parallel. And it goes back to what we were talking about earlier. I think it's this sense of a loss of control. the loss of the, you know, both in economic terms and also in terms of what there's the sense of all around people of a loss of control over their lives and the fabric of the social fabric of their lives fraying in ways that that they find really unsettling. And I think that that is incredible. I think that the economic picture in the U.S. is and was worse in one sense, that the, you know, the income picture, I think more recently the declines in income in America were worse. So I don't think it's exactly the same, but you have that same sense of a real divide in society between people who are benefiting from the changes the modern world are bringing and leading that change and enjoying it and enjoying the way things are going, and then huge numbers of people who just feel, you know, economically and socially left out and victimized and marginalized, and had seen that happen regardless of who was in power. And I think that's the thing that that connects the two, is that that in the UK, you people in that situation that I describe, despair, you know, really struggling financially and despairing of what's going on in their communities in terms of, you know, local institutions and so on, thinking, well, this has been going on under a Tory government, and then we had New Labour and we got Tory again. It doesn't matter who you vote for. Whoever you vote for, it's the same kind of people who are in charge, the bankers and the bureaucrats and the accountants, and the decisions always seem to be the same. And the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. And that's literally true. That's not a slogan. That's literally the case. The rich got richer and working people got poorer. And that's the same thing here. That income picture that we talked about earlier, where basically for the last 20
years... And you could probably layer that graph onto the voting
map. Right. And so, you know, people say, okay, we had 8 years of Bush and 8 years of Obama. And at the end of all that, we are poorer. And the rich are richer. And so what they say is, it doesn't matter who you vote for. It doesn't matter whether you vote Democrat or Republican. The rich get richer. We get poorer. It's the same people that are in charge. I'm sick of all of that. This guy looks different. Let's give it a try. Same with Brexit, where it wasn't a general election. It was like it was just a referendum. And so you say, well, actually, this is different. This time, it might actually make something really change. Because as a result of it, something either we leave or we don't. And so actually, this really will be an opportunity to take back power. I do have power. This really will change things. And I think that meant, certainly in the – I mean, the data shows that in the UK, one of the things that happened was that people just hadn't voted before, came out and voted for Brexit. And it's those people who'd so given up on politics with the traditional parties, they thought it doesn't matter who you vote for. It's the same outcome. They thought with this thing, this referendum, I really might get a change. So I will come out and vote. I think you saw a little bit of that here. I haven't seen data as strongly suggesting that in the US.
Yeah, but certainly we've all talked to Republicans who said, well, I know what I'm going to get with Clinton. And I'm scared a little bit with Trump, but it's something different. I've heard that directly from people who were maybe not sold on the Trump idea, but voted for exactly the reason that
just
you're suggesting.
Something might
him.
Change. We've had no change, whoever's been elected, for the last few decades. And finally, here's something that might be different. I think the real point, actually, it's something I said earlier, which is, will it lead to actual change that benefits people and makes a material difference in their lives? That's a much longer term. Well, not that long, actually, because, you know, Trump will be judged, certainly by me, you know, who you know, saw his campaign as an opportunity to get change, but only if you actually deliver on the policy side. And you don't see much sign of that at all. Well, there's zero sign of that.
Well, and in fact, here we are at 100 days with a lot of confusion about what the agenda is.
So I think the real question is, like, will the policy changes follow? And equally with Brexit, will this actually lead to better outcomes for people? And you won't know that. And this is the point I make in the Brexit debate, which is that Brexit was just the start, in the sense that if Britain leaves the EU, what then happens is that the government of the UK has the policy freedom to make its own choices in a way that it didn't have before.
But isn't this why Theresa May called the election now?
Right.
Before, it's too soon to really see the results of this big Yelp
election. And the results will not be determined by there's far, I mean, in the jumping around, but there's far too much focus in the current Brexit conversation about the negotiation. Is she going to get a good deal? Is she going to get a bad deal? Yes. Is she going to be in the single market? Are we going to have this, that, the other, right? That's far less important than what the British government, whether it's Theresa May's or anyone else's, actually does with the newfound policy freedom that it will have post leaving the EU. So the real test is not going to be what happens in these negotiations, is what they do afterwards. And so we'll and for that, you see, in the UK, I argued for what I described as a positive, outward looking version of Brexit, where you leave the EU and then you actually have a global outlook where you make the UK an outward looking, optimistic, positive place where you welcome people from around the world, not just on your doorstep in the EU. It's a sort of enterprise hub, trading with everyone, open to everyone. It's a really positive, exciting vision of a globally engaged UK.
Right. And that's not the conversation that has been had either in the UK about Brexit or here
correct.
In the United States
exactly
about Trump.
Right.
It's much more about closing things down. There's a
yes.
negative side that, you know, your analysis has been much more classic economic disruption, inequality, populism is what drove these elections. But a lot of people think that's part of it. But the other part of it is the part that's different than your own views, which is a much darker view
yes,
of, you know,
I think
the
word.
Negative theory
yeah.
of human relations, that Trump is about slamming the door shut and saying America first, that Brexit was about slamming the door shut and fundamentally was an immigration-driven backlash.
Well, that's yes, I accept that characterization, and I totally disagree with it, and I will fight against it. And that's why, even though I'm based here now, and my focus is mainly here. Although Crowdpack, you know, my business is now, we launched in the UK and also in France and hopefully elsewhere around the world. So we do have a global aspiration. But I do get involved from time to time back in the debate on Brexit in the UK. I feel a responsibility to do that. Having got involved and made an argument for it in the first place, I feel it's my responsibility to try and help, you know, steer the conversation in a positive direction. And so one way I tried to characterize that was that for the last, again, maybe too nerdy for some of our listeners, depends how closely they're following it, but the big kind of theme in the Brexit conversation in the UK was like, are we going to have a hard Brexit or a soft Brexit? Are we going to completely leave the EU and the single market? Another thing which is described as hard Brexit, or we can sort of slightly stay in and that's a soft Brexit. I said, well, that's just completely wrong, because of course it has to be, in those terms, a hard Brexit, because the main things that were argued over in the referendum campaign were sovereignty over national law. So the British Parliament would regain its sovereignty over laws. At the moment, it is subservient to EU law. EU law trumps British law, and that is not democratic. And that was one of the main things in the election campaign. You can't be a part of you, in order to achieve that, you have to have what's described as a hard Brexit. My argument was the real choice is not hard or soft. That was decided in the referendum. The real choice is open or closed. Literally, that's the term I use the term closed. And I said the whole point of Brexit was to be more open to the world. And it would be a disaster for this to turn into, and I used exactly the word you used, dark. And I was very concerned that immediately after Brexit, Theresa May, who remember was on the other side of the argument, and to a certain extent, I think, was trying to reassure those who voted to leave that even though she had actually been on the other side, she was as good as anyone at fighting for Brexit and so on. And I think she overcompensated. And I think, and this was really damaging, I think, to the international reputation of the UK, which is that in the months after taking over, the message that was coming out of the UK was a dark, negative, closed version of Brexit. And I was very angry about that. I thought this is not what I argued for. It was not what any of the leading conservatives argued for. If you look at the arguments of Boris Johnson, Michael Gove, Daniel Hannan, myself, the conservatives on the Brexit side, I'm not talking about Nigel Farage and the other camp, I'm talking about the official
right.
pro-Brexit campaign run by mainly the Conservatives, but also some Labour MPs, Labour politicians as well. That was the argument, the open argument. That was what we all said. And so when people say, oh, well, you may have felt that, but actually the whole thing was it became a license for dark negative things about immigration. My response is, well, it's not what we argue. And it wasn't just me. It was all of us in the official Conservative Brexit campaign. And I think that I'm pleased to see that Theresa May has changed the tone of what she said. I think a crucial turning point, ironically, given the demonization of Davos in this whole kind of discussion. Actually, she made a speech at Davos, which I thought was a bit of a pivot and very welcome, where she talked explicitly. She used the term, I think, global Britain, and presented this in exactly the terms that I would like to see. But I have to say, I think the damage was done. I think the first impression was this dark, negative, closed version of Brexit. I think it was really a shame.
So let's finish up on the home front. First of all, this has been a fascinating conversation, and you can see very much why it is that Fox News has decided to give you your own show to talk about your ideas. And I think you're calling it The Next Revolution, which I thought was interesting. This is going to launch soon, by the way, for those of you who've enjoyed listening to this. Sometime, I think, maybe even in June, you'll be able to see this on Fox and on Sunday nights.
Sunday night, 9 yeah. Eastern, yep.
But the revolution that you're talking about here, it is both the follow-on to these electoral revolutions in the United States and in the UK, but it's also about this policy agenda.
Yeah, for me, that's the crucial part, because I think that what matters is dealing with this. I would say it's a massive economic crisis, the fact that you have so many people in America out of work, who can't, even if you have a job, income's down. Of course, now we're talking a lot about the opioid epidemic. We weren't a year ago, but it's good that we are now. But that's just a symptom of a very, very deep malaise. And I think we need revolutionary policies to deal with that. Reform of everything. I mean, I wrote about a lot of this in my book, More Human, which came out in the UK 2 years ago.
And last year here.
And the theme of that book is, and that the subtitle is, Designing a World Where People Come First. And the theme of all of that is this notion of decentralizing powers.
I'm fascinated, too. You're joining this big media organization that also is in crisis. You're out in Silicon Valley where all the companies are in perpetual creative destruction or, creative creation. Your wife was just in the middle of the Uber drama. What do you take away from, all these institutions being in crisis, really? You've been in politics where it's melting down. You're now in media where it's melting down.
Well, I think generally the changes that you're seeing are in a positive direction. I think that
maybe that's because you live in California. It's very sunny and positive there.
Well, that's true, and I love the culture.
Not everybody is creative.
Well, that's right. Well, I think that's the flip side of it. So I think that there's a massive debate, which I really want to get into on the show and elsewhere, about where are the jobs going to come from? What kind of jobs do we want? How are people going to make a living to afford the basics of a decent life and have not just economic security but opportunity as well?
Okay, final question. Put your old genius campaign strategist political guru hat back on here for a second. Donald Trump invites you over for lunch. It's day 99 of my presidency. What's the one thing I need to do to turn this around and to make it be seen as a bigger success?
Well, I'm tempted to say make everyone read my book and then implement it, because I wrote it because I believe that it will help solve some of these problems. But that's a bit ridiculous. I think that I'd focus on one thing. Productivity is the big thing that's going wrong. And actually, you've got to really make sure that people have the skills and the talents and the wherewithal to earn a decent income. That's what we need to do. And I believe that we can do that. We shouldn't just despair and say that's never going to happen. Therefore, we just have to accept that there's always going to be people who don't. And and therefore, I think things like the minimum wage and so on are important, but they're not the answer. You need to improve people's productive capacity. That's family policy, schools and training. Long-term stuff. I don't see that as being something that's likely to come from this White House.
Right.
However, in the short term, there is one thing that really would be useful right now, and that is to boost economic growth. That will not solve this long-term problem of what's for people to transform their lives, but it will certainly help in the short term to lift people up. It was the number one thing he was elected to do, which is to get the economy moving. In my view, it should have been the number one thing he did. He should have started with it and not waste any time in getting the economy moving. It is not going to solve these problems in the long term, but it could do some good in the short term just to get growth rates up. Now, I've got very specific views about the details of that, but action to stimulate the economy, get things moving, that you really stick with that focus. Forget everything else. Just do that.
Sounds like smart advice. My guess is if you get an audience, Donald Trump will be all ears to listen to it. Steve, I want to thank you so much for joining us. I can't wait to see your new show and to see what you do with it. And, you know, you're such a unique voice, I think, in American politics today, because you can speak to politics, but you speak to ideas and policy in a way that crosses a lot of our very sort of hardened lines. And I always find that stimulating and refreshing. And I'm just delighted to have you here today. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It was a real pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you. My original conversation with Steve Hilton took place before this week's Manchester bombing and the strange twist this caused in the British elections. So we talked with him again Friday to get his thoughts about how this all will affect Prime Minister Theresa May and her efforts to pursue the Brexit, which Steve supported last year, and which, interestingly, Theresa May did not. So, Steve Hilton, it's wonderful to be back with you for the Global Politico. We are looking at just an extraordinary week here in Great Britain. I've been here since the beginning of the week when this tragic attack happened in Manchester, and really the unprecedented convergence between a British general election and being suspended in the middle of a terrorist act. It's only 1 year, not quite, since the Brexit vote. What I've been struck by is the incredible uncertainty here in the UK today. It's a politically really up in the air moment. What do you make of it?
Well, I think that an attack like we saw in Manchester does just bring everyone to a standstill and stop thinking about what was going on and just remember again, you know, in a very human way, the cost of these things. But that does fade, and it does, and it sadly fades, because I think one of the problems is that we do have these moments after a horrific attack like we saw where people do come together. You do see a unity of purpose. You do see common commitment made to action to stop it from happening again. But I'm afraid the actions that result from these attacks never seem to be quite sufficient. And I think one thing that's interesting is to see whether, when the general election campaign resumes in the UK, whether it just goes back to the agenda of economic issues and questions around the funding and provision of services like elderly care, or actually legitimate questions about how the authorities in the UK, the government and the security services, may have made errors that actually helped contribute to this attack.
You know, I was really struck by the fact that Theresa May, when she called the general election, she said basically, well, this will be the Brexit election. This will be the election that is needed in order for me to strengthen my hand negotiating. And yet, amazingly enough, it's really not the Brexit election. I don't know what it'll turn into being. But up until now, what's striking is the absence of a conversation. You and I talked about basically the backstory of Brexit.
Yes.
What's the next story of Brexit? Do you think that, it will actually, the campaign will be helpful in clarifying Brexit at all?
It doesn't look like it. I mean, there's two aspects to that question, I think. First of all, one thing that I've said consistently is that when people talk about the strategy of the UK government for the Brexit negotiations and debate whether that will, what impact that will have and whether it's better to have a good deal, whether it's better to have a bad deal or no deal, that conversation, My answer on all of that was to say, you know what, the really important decision will not be what happens in the negotiations. It will be what happens in the first general election that happens after Brexit, where you will see different views put forward as to what policy changes should be implemented now that you have a situation where the British government genuinely has autonomy in areas of policy which it didn't have before. What are you going to do with the new freedom that you have after leaving the EU? That's the real debate. Now, actually, since this election is happening before anyone knows what the outcome of the Brexit process will be, I think that's one of the reasons you're not having that really important discussion, because it doesn't really, well, it hasn't, it literally hasn't happened yet. Brexit hasn't happened, and therefore it's just hard to really set out a manifesto that says, now that we've left the EU, this is the kind of economy we want to see. This is the kind of engagement we want with the rest of the world. This is how we're going to make the most of the freedoms we have, having left the EU. That's just not possible before you've left. And so that's why it's slightly odd. You're right that it was going to be the Brexit election, but it seems that other concerns are dominating.
Well, you know, we'll have to see, of course, what the ultimate outcome is. But I have to say, I'm leaving Great Britain today feeling like it's a country that's very much in the middle of a story. In the middle of a political revolution, it's not clear how it ends. Kind of feel like back in the United States, right? We're in the middle of the Trump story. We have no idea how this unusual experiment is going to turn out. And that's kind of how it feels back here in the UK. So, Steve Hilton, I want to thank you again for joining us on the Global Politico. And, you know, I think your conversation around the backstory of Brexit and how it does and doesn't compare with what's going on in the U.S. is really fascinating. And your show debuts very soon, June 4th, right?
Sunday, June 4th, 9 Eastern, exactly.
Well, congratulations and thanks again.
Thank you, Susan. It's great to be with you.
On our road trip to Manchester this week, we talked to a wide range of folks about the terrorist attack and what it might mean for the country at such an uncertain moment about its future. Here are two people in particular I thought our Global Politico listeners might find illuminating.
First of all, were you nervous to come to Manchester?
I wasn't. My wife was. My wife was going, "You were still going? Is it going ahead?" I went, my attitude was that you've got to crack, you've just got to go on. Didn't really think about it. I think that's just a British response.
So what do you think about the campaign? Are you paying close attention? Do you think it will be affected by it?
I think there'll be less animosity and a calmer, less brutal campaign as a result, because it just wouldn't be appropriate.
What do you like this campaign? Are you authoritarian?
No. I am a massive Remona. I think that the Brexit is just a disaster. Her going hard Brexit lost me completely.
Do you think what you're going through here in Britain with Brexit, is it all comparable to what we're going through in the States with Trump and the divided America?
Oh yeah, I mean, I cannot believe, I thought our electoral system was a basket case until I saw that electoral college vote. Trump is just such a divisive character, and I just watch with interest to see how long he can survive.
You don't have heard about the Polish or Czech or any other country terrorist. I'm sorry to say, but this is the fact, yeah? So, but the still British people think about it. They remove the immigrants, so they will be quiet. But it's not we. When I came here, over 4 years, I start working. I didn't get any benefits because I don't need the benefits.
So you were here in England last year, here in Manchester, when they had the Brexit vote?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And were you surprised?
A little bit, but generally I got also many colleagues, British colleagues or friends on the French colleagues, and they are surprised also as well, because looks like they don't know what they voted. I don't want to be rude, but I think it's about the logical, you know, thinking is logical. If you do something, you have to think about what will be next, because it's not like a divorce. Sometimes divorce is very, very, very hard, yeah?
Well, exactly. You can fight about that for years, and it exactly. looks like they are going to fight about this for years.
I think the British are completely different, like the rest of Europe, yeah? Or, I don't know, for example, like we, I mean the east of Europe, we talk about all the time about, you know, we think about what will be next, what happened, you know. We try to have a look what will be in the future.
So that's our road trip to the 2017 British elections. Thanks again for joining me at the Global Politico. I'm Susan Glasser, and I hope you'll keep listening to the Global Politico. Subscribe to us and rate us on iTunes or whatever your favorite podcast platform is. Sign up for our new weekly newsletter at politico.com. And of course, send me thoughts, feedback, and ideas at sglasser@politico.com anytime. Thanks again for listening.